You know, these very low-carb diets or a ketogenic diet, I mean, that is great if you're planning to circumnavigate the Arctic Circle solo and eat, you know, seal blubber the whole way. Like, hell yeah. Like, why don't you do that? You need to be ketogenic if that's what you're going to do and you're bringing no supplies with you. That's great. But that's really any competitive athlete, even if we're talking ultra endurance, you know, we have resources available. And so we don't have to see if we can completely overhaul our, you know, the way that we use fuel and try to adapt to something that's not high performance.
Hey, this is Travis Macy. I'm an athlete, author, speaker, and coach from Salida, Colorado. Welcome to episode 106. We're talking here today with John Gaston and Josiah Mido, a couple friends of mine from the Colorado endurance racing scene. These guys are both top pros who are still hitting it hard, doing well after years of racing out there. John Gaston is one of America's top ski mountaineers and mountain bikers. He is also CEO and PLM at Strafe Outerwear over the mountains there in Aspen. John's many accomplishments include many ski mountaineering national titles and overseas competitions on the World Cup scene. He was second place at the Leadville 100 mountain bike race. If you know anything about Leadville or mountain biking, you know that is a very, very impressive and solid accomplishment. And he has ski mountaineering course records at the Power of Four and Elk Mountains Grand Traverse, two of Colorado's most prominent and epic events. Josiah Mido is the Xterra Triathlon World Champion. He has also won big races in just about any sport under the sun. As John put it in our conversation here, he said something like, Josiah, I figured you just done everything over the years. And Josiah has done pretty much everything, which is why we're so glad to have him and John along to talk today about fueling. We're talking about what you put into your body while you are training and racing in all of these great sports we enjoy: cycling, mountain biking, running, triathlon, ski mountaineering, adventure racing, and more. And also a little bit about, you know, what you do and don't put into your body around the clock. We talk about how to balance that amongst family life. John, Josiah, and I are all parents of kids of various ages. Josiah's kids are now in high school and out of high school. John's kids are still fairly young, and mine are kind of at that in-between age. Should we reflect on that a little bit? Really proud to bring you this interview. I've actually been sitting on it a while just because we've had other things come out, other interviews and that kind of stuff. But I have already shared the rough draft of this with many of my own endurance coaching clients. And I have to say, people have been really glad to hear this. It's provided a framework for those ongoing conversations that I have with endurance athletes on this exact topic of fueling. Speaking of fueling, check out thefeed.com/Travis Macy. As you know, The Feed and Kyoku, which is a brand owned by The Feed, are the presenting sponsors of this podcast. They also support John and Josiah with their fueling needs for the many things that they do. So again, after you listen to this podcast and get some ideas maybe for how you want to fuel, go to thefeed.com/Travis Macy. You'll find a wide range of products on there, including the USWE packs, USWE. You've probably seen these packs out there, maybe on the gravel bike scene, mountain bike scene. I tried one out this weekend for the first time and really enjoyed it. I was lucky enough to head up the second Flatiron in Boulder, Colorado, did a little scramble up that with my friend Mike Hogan, and I was glad to have the USWE 12-liter pack along with me. Carried all my stuff. It was very handy, and it didn't bounce around. They've got a unique, sort of weight distribution and harness system that was definitely good and left my hands and legs free to move to get myself safely up that second flat iron and boulder. All right, that's enough for me for now. Hope you enjoy this conversation with John and Josiah. And I'm telling you, if you are an endurance athlete, if you're figuring out what works for you for training and racing fuel, you're probably going to want to listen to this a couple times, because these guys say a lot of really good and powerful things. Without further ado, here they are, John and Josiah, talking about fueling.
Hey, Travis.
Hey, John, how are you?
Hey.
Josiah, hey. Good to see you guys. Right. Yeah.
Good to see you.
Thanks a ton for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Always fun to talk with you. Josiah, yeah. Good to see you again, or virtually. Yeah.
I just appreciate you guys coming, and I'm excited to talk about fueling for endurance races, and honored and pumped to be here with two of America's best mountain endurance athletes. Josiah Mitto, you know him from the podcast previously. Josiah was the Xterra world champion, among many other things that he's done here and there, and is still going. Josiah and I talked previously about crushing it as an athlete well into one's 40s. And John Gaston, also previously on the podcast, he was on last spring with Cam Smith after they won the Elk Mountains Grand Traverse ski race. And since then, I believe John has finished, I think it was second place at the Leadville 100 mountain bike race in August. And I think, John, are you just back from Europe? Were you doing some ski mountaineering World Cup events over there?
I'm actually not. I'm in Aspen right now, but I ended up canceling that trip. Unfortunately, the Swiss round of the World Cup was canceled due to a lack of snow and postponed until sometime in February. So I've got to kind of rearrange my travel schedule a little bit, but all good. Aspen's great. Snow's been amazing. So yeah. No complaints on my part.
Yeah, that's right. It has been snowing in Colorado, and maybe that's a topic for another time, global warming and the impact on winter sports and other kinds of things. So, so John, you've probably been ski training. Josiah, what have you been up to as of late?
Well, believe it or not, I'm training for a marathon, a road marathon.
Okay.
which was a pretty tough December to do that. So a lot of snow-packed roads and, I don't know, put in some miles. So it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Go back to the roots.
All right. Good for you, Josiah. And which, are you signed up for one? Do you have one targeted?
Yeah, I'm going to do the Mesa Marathon in a week and a half, Mesa, Arizona.
Okay.
Yeah. So Sullivan's down there in Tempe. And so I picked a race by him, and it's just kind of an off season thing to do, kind of a bucket list. I've never actually raced a road marathon. So I figured I'm not getting any younger, and I better do it while I can still put up a decent time.
Yeah. All right. Wait,
never in your whole career?
No, I never.
Wow. I honestly peg you as someone who's literally raced everything. so that kind of shocks me, but that's super cool.
I know.
All right. And Josiah, do you have, I know with road marathons aren't my thing either, but I do know with road marathon, like a big piece of the training is like you set a time like, oh, I want to do this time. And then you kind of train for that pace and you do all these intervals, and stuff. Is there a time in mind, or is that something you say publicly?
Well, it's fine. I'd like to go like low 230s.
Yeah. All right.
But it's tough with training at this altitude too.
Yeah.
You kind of have to have a little bit of faith that you can, run 20, 30 seconds per mile faster when you get down an elevation. So we'll see. Yep. The wheels could totally come off and I could just limp my way to the finish and run, yeah, you know, 30 minutes slower. So who knows?
All right, man. Well, that's good. Good for you. Way to diversify. And I'm sure your aerobic engine is ready, and I hope that the legs are ready to keep up with it. And I will add, both of these guys, you're also fathers, you know, active parents. We've talked about Josiah's kids are now faster than all of us. And John's kind of at the other end. John, remind us, you have at least one little kid. Is that right?
Yeah, I've actually got three. I got a 1, 3, and 5-year-old. So definitely the other end of the spectrum from Josiah, but it's fun in a different way. I think it's super cool when I see Josiah, like on Instagram or something, sharing, you know, racing or doing fun stuff with his kids. And that just, that seems super special. It must be a blast. I have a good time in mind for sure. Our girl, our 1-year-old, she's obviously really small still, but 3.5-year-old and 5-year-old are just like getting to that age where it's so much more fun to actually go and do sort of mini adventures with them, whether that's like skiing or hiking or biking. And, you know, like it's definitely a little trickier. I'm sure Josiah, don't tell him, but, or either of you, but, you know, playing it around training and work, it definitely makes it tough sometimes, but it's super cool. It's super fun. And definitely, I think, maybe, you know, whether it's like bad session or something or a bad race, brings you back down to reality a bit when you kind of helps put stuff in perspective, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I like it, man. Yeah. And both of you guys impressed me so much in that way of, you know, parenting, training and racing. You also, you know, you both work, John, you run the Strafe, what is it? Strafe ski outerwear. And Josiah, you know, you got your coaching and everything else going on. So, you know, you're not one trick ponies, and you guys have both been doing it for a long time. So, probably a big key to that is the fueling. So, let's get into that. What I'm thinking is let's talk briefly about round the clock fueling or eating, because I think that's a question that we probably all get a lot. You know, what do you eat? What should I eat from athletes and potential clients? And then from there, we'll kind of get into fueling ideas for races themselves. And I kind of broke it down roughly into races that are like 0 to 2 hours, 2 to 6 hours. And actually Josiah's got a marathon coming up, so we might even ask him about his fueling plan. 6 to 12 hours, 12 to 24 hours, and 24 hours plus. So first of all, round the clock, either of you guys want to kick it off? What do you eat? You know, are you on any kind of, you know, one of these fad diets or anything, or you just eat whatever you want? Is it the McDonald's diet? You know, I've been to Josiah's house before. There's various things going on there. How about John, you started off. What do you eat around the clock?
Yeah. You know, I guess I should preface and say that probably like most people, you know, there's always room for improvement, and I'm not immune to that. But I don't follow any, you know, specific diet or try to limit myself, you know, too harshly, I guess. I definitely kind of overall probably subscribe to like the everything in moderation mentality, try to eat, you know, especially, well, I would say, you know, race day or the day before a big race is maybe different. So let's leave that till later. But on the whole, I think, you know, a lot of vegetables, a lot of like whole grains and, some meat. I don't honestly eat that much meat, and it's not because I have an issue with it. I just, for one reason or another, kind of find myself not having probably maybe even as much as I should. So, I do kind of sometimes, if I'm not being super cognizant about it, find myself sort of behind a bit on protein intake. So this winter in particular, I try to put a more concerted effort into upping that, see how it plays out. But no, just a balanced sort of overall diet, kind of trending with the seasons a little bit as to what's fresh and what I feel like eating. But I don't really try to, you know, pigeonhole or just sort of like get too strict on it, because I think like one of the keys to any kind of healthy diet is that it has to be sustainable and something you enjoy and can stick to and not for like a week or a month or 2 months, but for years, you know?
Yeah. I like it. I agree with a lot of that. John, when my kids were little, like your kids, I ate a lot of mac and cheese because I was making it. Like, kids always want mac and cheese. And, you know, Josiah's laughing there too. Like, it's quick, it's easy, you know, like you can buy
I used to say when my kids were younger, I'd say, how do you want your cheese? You want grilled cheese? You want cheese quesadilla?
That's right.
Totally.
Yeah, you know, a box of mac and cheese costs like 7 cents or something, you know?
I have nothing against mac and cheese. And I, you know, like a lot of kids' food is in some ways like perfect, like pre-race food, because it's sometimes kind of overly simple and tastes great and it's cheap and you can make it anywhere in a hotel room or whatever. And that's kind of ticks a lot of boxes. But yeah, no, I mean, admittedly, you know, I will find myself eating a lot of like the kids' leftovers, you know, all the time, especially if I like, you know, I'll save something thinking I'll, you know, heat it up for them the next day. And then I get like ravenously hungry and that ends up being like my dessert. I'm like, well, sorry, kids.
Excellent. I like it. Josiah, how about you? What's your, you know, sort of round the clock nutrition plan or lack thereof?
more like lack thereof. But speaking of kids, one thing that's kind of convenient is to blame your bad food habits on your kids.
There you go. Yeah, so, exactly.
You know, when people are peeking in your grocery cart at a grocery store.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, yeah. One of my kids really likes that ice cream, those potato chips. But no, my around the clock eating, I would say it sounds fairly similar to John's. I grew up mostly vegetarian, not vegan, but vegetarian. And but it was not strict at all. We never ate red meat. You know, occasionally had chicken, occasionally had fish, but you know, we might go, you know, a week straight with, or a month straight without having any meat products, but we would have dairy. So we'd have a fair amount of that. So I've kind of carried that into my adult life. And, you know, I definitely have, it's definitely a high carbohydrate diet, and it does kind of follow that percentage of carbohydrate kind of follows my training volume, you know? So if I am cutting back on my training, my percentage of carbohydrate does go down. Whereas protein and fat might stay a little bit more similar. But I've been known to have some pretty boring, bland habits. So for about a 15-year stretch there, I had the same breakfast and the same lunch. I'd say every day, but like 5 days a week.
I haven't heard that, Josiah. This is boring, but I'm also interested. What can you tell us what you ate? I mean, is it a secret or?
Well, it's not much of a secret. So it was yogurt and granola for breakfast, but that would vary where I'd throw some fruit in there. It was mostly due to my lifestyle. So I would have, you know, 6 a.m. swim, and I'd have clients in the gym that I had to meet by 8 o'clock. And I'd pretty much go like bam, bam, bam with clients throughout the day. And then any break that I'd have would be training. And so I'd pack my breakfast, pack my lunch. I'd eat my breakfast on my drive from the pool to the gym. So I'd, you know, do the steering wheel with the knee thing. And
yep.
So yogurt granola worked pretty well. I could spoon that into my mouth. And then I used to have all these little containers that had different words on them, but I would fill them with random things. So it'd be like walnuts or raisins and, you know, different things like that, or flaxseed. But I'd call it like, you know, courage or like discipline or something.
I like it. Oh, man.
So that was my breakfast. And then, you know, in my bag. So this started when we shared a car for several years. So I ran everywhere. And I've actually brought that back a little bit. I call it the 2-foot express. But peanut butter and jelly doesn't work great in a backpack for a long period of time because the jelly kind of seeps through.
Yeah, it gets squished. Yeah.
Yeah, the jam. So I switched to peanut butter raisins. For that 15-year stretch, I had peanut butter raisin sandwiches because the raisin doesn't leak out, right? And it wasn't because I liked it, but
yeah.
But you don't have to like it, right? And so then I throw in an apple, banana, you know, 2 peanut butter and raisin sandwiches. And that was pretty much my lunch for about 15 years.
Man.
Not too excited.
Yeah. Well, you got protein, fat, carbs, way to go. Huh. And that, does that mean, Josiah, and maybe we're getting into a little bit of the, you know, training methodology, those morning swims, were you doing those in a fasted state? You know, when you woke up in the morning, did you have just water? Did you have some coffee? Did you consume anything, or did you just jump right in the pool?
No, so those are all fasted, and I still do. So now I run to the pool and run home because I do most of my work from home, and so I do some commuting on foot still. And so at least 3 days a week, I'm running to the pool at 5:30 in the morning, swimming, running home. And so that's all fasted and totally unintentional. And so this intermittent fasting thing kind of is a craze right now. And it's not really something that I advocate at all. I actually advocate a little more against it, but I do a version of that, you know, several days a week. But it's not, you know, 16 hours, you know, fasted. But.
Yep. Nice.
Huh. Well, because I'm still eating at a normal time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're on the topic. John, do you ever do any of that? You know, this listeners may have heard of this concept of intermittent fasting or fasted training with the idea of boosting fat metabolism. John, do you, do you do any of that?
I mean,
do you do any, you know, fasted training?
You know, that's sort of always a topic of some debate, especially in the cycling world. You know, a few years ago, that was like all the rage. Some teams, it still is. I've dabbled with it, and I will occasionally do some fasted rides, but honestly, it's pretty rare, and I never do particularly long ones. And I make sure they're, you know, my easy endurance days. And I mean, I don't have a problem doing, you know, a 3 or 4 hour just endurance ride fasted per se. But more and more of the science that I keep hearing and seeing in the last couple of years is sort of debunking that. And when you're doing 1,000 hours a year, you know, a lot of common logic says you're already, regardless of what you're intaking, you know, getting pretty fat adapted, at least, you know, but during exercise. And the benefits, frankly, I think overall for me, I think they outweigh the benefits of training fueled, I should say, I find outweigh any of the potential negatives or the benefits of fasted training. And, you know, especially I feel like last year was almost like a sea change from the cycling world, at least, where a lot of pros, and whether it was the Lifetime Grand Prix and, you know, a lot of those athletes being open about their nutrition strategies, or more pro teams being open about it, you know, you saw just general like carbs per hour just going through the roof, and almost everyone I could name was doing at least 120 grams an hour in those races. And I jumped on that bandwagon. And honestly, I got to say, like, I always fueled pretty well. But when I started trying these like really high numbers, I could train so much and I could recover so much faster in 6 hour rides, you know, leading up to Leadville, and not be just shattered, you know, the rest of the day. And, I genuinely bought into it. I believe it. And so I definitely, you know, I will still occasionally do the fasted ride, but the vast majority of stuff for me is pretty well fueled, not always maximally by any means, but, you know, enough to where I don't feel like it's compromising the workload whatsoever. Cause I feel like that is for me the most important, is just being able to consistently nail the training loads and the recovery from those to do it again the next day.
Nice. I like it. I agree with all of it. I'm thinking back to two moments in my athletic career. One was in 2013. Josiah was coaching me for the Leadman series. And I remember you saying, Josiah, if you stay on top of fueling while you're training, your recovery is going to be so much better. You don't get run down. And I agree. And that's what I try to do. And I try to counsel clients on. I also remember, back to final point about this kind of, you know, high fat, low carb, or the fasted sort of thing. In 2016, I was heavily into ultra running, and compared to, let's say, cycling or even a road marathon, with ultra running, you're going pretty slow, and the entire race should be aerobic in pace and effort. And so it maybe makes a little more sense that the you know, super high fat kind of thing might be effective. And I went pretty far down that road. And I remember during that period, or when I was thinking about it, I remember talking to Josiah and saying, hey, you know, what do you think about this? And Josiah, you said it was a bad idea. And I should have listened to you, because in hindsight, I think I took it too far, you know, basically too much training, not enough carbohydrate fuel. And again, I'd been an endurance athlete for a long time. I was probably pretty well fat adapted already. But for me, I'm quite sure that it contributed to, some acute injuries and also just burnout and unsustainability of that running, training, and racing volume. So, I would agree. You know, there are risks for sure, and I still do. You know, so if I wake up and I'm going to go for an easy run with my dogs in the morning, you know, I'll just get up and go for the run and have some breakfast afterwards. But I would also, tell people to watch out. Don't do too much without enough fuel, because there's risks for sure.
Yeah, I think that we're all kind of on a similar page with that, which is pretty refreshing to hear. I do think that, really simply, I always tell people to try to do more with more. Don't try to, it's just not intuitive to do more with less. And I think, you know, we can dig a little deeper into that, but, you know, these very low carb diets or a ketogenic diet, I mean, that is great if you're planning to circumnavigate the Arctic Circle solo and eat, you know, seal blubber the whole way. Like, hell yeah. Like, why don't you do that? you need to be ketogenic if that's what you're going to do, and you're bringing no supplies with you. That's great. But that's really any competitive athlete, even if we're talking ultra endurance, we have resources available. And so we don't have to see if we can, you know, completely overhaul our, you know, the way that we use fuel and try to adapt to something that's not high performance.
Yep. Nice.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I mean, I should also, I guess, preface that this just elaborate a little bit in that I don't really do ultra events. And so I don't have much of a leg to stand on in regards to, speaking to that need for tweaking, or being flexible with your fueling. And I mean, I used to always joke if you couldn't win a race in, you know, about 6 hours, and I had no interest in lining up, because at the time that was like the Leadville record or like the Grand Traverse. And I don't think I'm really quite cut out for those truly long races. And the flip side of that is any races, frankly, shorter than that, you are going quite hard, at really all times. And so, to me, focusing on the work capacity that I needed to develop just every day in training was of much greater importance than being able to, like, you know, run at a low level for 24 hours, which, you know, I some people may have to do. And so I'm not, you know, frankly, can't speak later on to whether that's got more credibility in the ultra world. I will say again, you know, that last point in the cycling world is, you know, even a team like Sky or Ineos and their current guys, I remember listening to Grant Thomas on his podcast like very recently, and they were, you know, huge proponents of these, you know, 7-8 hour super easy, totally fasted rides. And he was talking about them like they get a bottle of like just protein during like halfway through, and just, you know, no carbs, and they would do this like day out early season. And now, like as of this season, he was mentioning like everything they do is like almost hyper fueled all the time, because which was kind of shocking to hear from him, to be honest. And you know, take it all with a grain of salt, right? Like, how much are they actually speaking or keeping kind of close to the vest on a podcast? But I do think overall you see less and less of that, even in the pro ranks. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
I do like what I see, it now goes across all endurance sports, whether you're talking about, Ironman triathlon or, SKIMO or bike racing. I do think that the new kind of performance enhancement is proper fueling, which is really hilarious because it's not new at all. It's like the oldest thing in the book, right? I mean, Frank Shorter drinking Coca-Cola during the marathon in 1976. It's not new, but it's almost like come full, had to go the other way first to have people realize that, oh, like if I want to, okay, what's my goal? Like the holy grail in any kind of training is recovering from the work that you do or adapting to the load, the training load, so that you can you know, maximize that training load. And so how do you do that? You rest better, you eat better, right? And so,
you know, I would imagine as a coach, like you see it all the time, though. That is, you're absolutely right. And yet that's like one of the first things for an athlete to sort of forget, or at least, you know, maybe they know it, but they're not actually acting on it or implementing it day to day. You know, everyone's so stressed on nailing their workout and their intervals, but then they get home and, you know, maybe they get a recovery shake in, but that's probably about it. And then, you know, almost everyone is low on sleep, low on, you know, like just general downtime to recover from those workloads. Cause you know, I mean, it's such an old cliche of, you know, you get faster when you're resting, when you're recovering, not when you're actually training, but it's so easy to forget in the moment because the intensity, you know, the workout is what feels hard. So you just assume you get that benefit just because you nail that. And, you know, you absolutely don't unless you do the other part as well.
Hey guys, Trav here. Real quick interruption. I mentioned to you, I went out and did a real fun scramble this week on the second Flatiron just outside of Boulder, Colorado, with my buddy Mike Hogan. And Mike and I had fun out there. We also continued our conversation. We're both, you know, adult parents of people who have Alzheimer's. And, you know, it's a tough path to walk. For me, connecting with other people on that same journey really has been important and powerful, and maybe a bit of silver lining, you might say. It's also made me think a lot about my own cognitive health, and honestly, created some significant worry about the possibility of my own cognitive decline. That's why I take Relevate, a supplement by NeuroReserve. This is a dietary supplement that brings your diet closer to the Mind and Mediterranean diets, which have been shown to decrease the possibility of cognitive decline. So I'm really, you know, I literally smile every day when I take this. It's just three simple pills, but I know that it's one of the things I can do to keep my brain going as well as possible for as long as possible, you know, in addition to sleeping well, you know, reducing stress, getting out and exercising myself, making sure I'm engaged, making sure I'm building a cognitive reserve by doing things like writing books and articles and coaching athletes and conducting podcasts, etc. I really know that this makes a difference. I'm glad to take it. My wife Amy takes it. Both of my parents take it. Again, that is the Relevate supplement by NeuroReserve. You can visit neuroreserve.com/TravisMacy and use the code TravisMacy, that's all one word, all caps, to get yourself a 15% discount. Again, on Relevate by NeuroReserve. And shout out to Mike Hogan. Thanks again for getting me up that second Flatiron there, buddy. That was pretty fun. I'm not a great rock climber, but man, I love it. And in the scrambling thing, it's kind of a neat way to combine running and climbing. If you're thinking about doing scrambling, please make sure that you do it nice and safely, as always. All right, back to John and Josiah here. John, I like what you said. You said up to, you know, 6 hours, you're pushing pretty hard. And that may be, you know, that is for, again, an elite athlete who has years of experience, whose body is ready to go hard that long. Josiah, you mentioned Ironman, you know, we got the Norwegian train or whatever, you know, those guys they've gotten their bodies able to go this hard for that long, which, you know, you can't do that off the couch. But let's say up to 6 hours, you're ready to push hard the whole time. 125 grams of carbs, that comes out to, I believe, 500 calories. You multiply by four. So that's a lot. Let's say if, you know, someone's doing a race and they're going to try to take in, you know, 125 grams, like we said, or maybe 500 calories, maybe it's 400 calories, maybe it's, you know, 350 calories. That's still a lot of carbohydrate. How are you guys gonna take that in? How do you get that much down? You know, like what specifically are you consuming?
I think that's where it has changed a lot. Yep. Because of new products that are available now with, you know, bigger clusters of maltodextrin. You're able to empty the stomach a little bit faster with the new thing. So it used to be, you know, Gatorade with a 6% solution. All you could pretty much take in was the get. So, I mean, you start doing the math. I'm like, okay, I can't even get 200 calories an hour.
Yeah.
You know, with this. And so it was really hard. And then you have tons of gastric distress if you're putting anything on top of that. So it used to be, well, if you're having a sports drink, you can't have a gel at the same time. You have to have the gel with water. And then, you know, so it used to be, we were just trying to stay consistent with our nutrition. But there weren't products available where you could really pack in the calories. So I think that's part of it. 500 would be a ton, right? And so you would have to have a specific supplement that your stomach could tolerate to be able to do that. But even if we, you know, talk about, you know, what, you know, even consistently taking in 200 calories an hour, that can be a game changer for people that are taking in 100. Okay, let's go from 200 to 300 calories an hour. Like that could be really important for some people that are, you know, training for something that's 3, 4, 5 hours long.
Yep. Yeah. How about you, John? How are you getting down that many in training and in racing? And I do think that's a good point, is if someone is seeking to race at a very high caloric intake, that's something you got to practice as well. And you need to practice with specific products, you know, ideally in a specific environment that's similar to the race as far as temperature and terrain and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's not always easy to replicate, but you know, if someone's riding in the Tour de France and they're taking in 500 calories every hour, that's something they've practiced for a long time. So John, what about you? What are you, are you just, you know, are you just eating dry pasta, or is there something better than that?
No. You know, honestly, I think, and I think some, like to Josiah's point, I think a lot of these, you know, newer fueling products, whether they're, you know, Martin or Beta Fuel or Never Second or similar, you know, have allowed people to start training to these higher numbers. But at the same time, when you actually break any of those products down, they're actually a lot simpler than, in my opinion, many of the endurance products of old. I mean, every one of these new super fuels are either somewhere between a 1-to-1 to a 2-to-1 maltodextrin to fructose ratio. And you add some sodium citrate to that, you know, depending on your preference. And that is, in my opinion, all you need. And I think where a lot of people used to go wrong, including myself, was just overcomplicating nutrition and eating, you know, too much solid food or too much maltodextrin without another type of sugar, you know, in a multi sugar fuel source. And I think in reality, like if you just step back, one of the coolest parts of any of these new products is how simple they are. And I'm a huge believer now after the last like couple of years, and especially last summer of testing a lot, is just to not overcomplicate it. You just take in sugar and salt, or not even salt, sodium. I mean, you don't even need the or want the chloride necessarily. So I am a huge fan personally of Never Second and Beta Fuel are my two favorites, just because that sodium alginate in the Martin I find freezes too much in the winter and also gets super gross when it's hot in the summer. But either way, you know, I personally mix, you know, between 60 to 90 grams of carbs into my bottle. And then I take the rest with one of those matching gels. And I think something like Never Second and Beta Fuel make it really easy to start training this stuff during your key, you know, longer sessions, which you absolutely need to do, to your point, to be able to, you know, both logistically handle it in a race, but also, you know, gastrointestinally absorb it and not get sick or have any issues. And I find it just super easy. You know, Beta Fuel, for example, one serving is 80 grams of the fluid and one gel is 40. And then Never Second is 90 in the bottle, 30 in a gel. And you can kind of mix and match depending on the terrain you're on, you know, how easy or it is or isn't to drink or eat, you know, and use your hands, which for schemo can be a really big challenge. But I think they make it very easy to sort of bump your way up from 60 grams an hour to 80 to 100 to 120. And it's up to the athlete to, you know, get their gut able to tolerate that. I think a lot of people used to say, like, you know, I just can't take in more than 200 calories an hour. I think that's been pretty well proven to just not be the case. And almost anyone can train their gut to handle 80 grams an hour by training it during training. But it's a question of, you know, a lot of people's training sessions understandably aren't long enough to where they technically feel that they need that. So they don't do it. And that's, I think, where they get into trouble. You know, if you're training an hour, 2 hours is your daily session, but then you're doing a long race and all of a sudden you're trying to handle this intake that you've never trained. Yeah, you can expect to have some problems. But, you know, my take is people need to really break it down to what their body actually needs. And that's sugar, fluid, and sodium for almost a race of any length, frankly. And to not put, like, I remember a guy sending me his spreadsheet before Unbound last year to look over. He's a friend of mine. And he had something like 7 or 8 different fuel sources listed out. And I understand that this is a long event and, you know, but people worry too much about stuff like palate fatigue and this concept of feeling nourished and full from solid foods. And again, I just hearken back to like the best of the best, the fast guys. They have just proven this time and time again in the last couple of seasons of like, nope, you know, the intensity is too consistent, too hard. Like, get your sugar, your fluid, your sodium, and stick to 1 or 2, really no more than 2 different types. And almost anyone can increase their carb intake if they really kind of simplify their previous, you know, I don't know, plan or thoughts on the matter. But I like that's it, just John. Me.
No, that's all good. I think that's all super helpful. And, you know, just to reiterate a couple points, one of them, you said training the gut, and sometimes, you know, for most athletes, especially if they're using these formulated products, whether that's the Morton or the Scratch Superfuel or other ones that John mentioned, you know, these things don't fall out of the sky and they cost money, but it is, you know, if you want to get ready to use that specific product in the race, you do need to train with it. So it might be, you know, think about that as part of the budget, or, you know, try to find a discount or something. John, you talked various numbers with the carbs, and just to reiterate, I think I heard that, you know, maybe you're doing something like the range of 240 to 360 calories per hour of carbohydrate that you'll get in the liquid source, but then supplementing that with gels. Where does that put you, John, as far as grams of sodium per hour? And is that something that you're varying depending on the season or how hot, work rate, et cetera?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely, like, my brain works better just looking at grams per hour than calories, because the numbers are so much simpler. I, you know, last summer really sold me on this, like, and, you know, maybe it's all mental too, right? But this, like, 120 grams per hour for the longer events, the kind of 4+ hour Leadville style events, to me, that had just measurable, impactful differences. So that's where I shoot for there. And then in these shorter races, I definitely drop that a bit to more of like that 80 to 90 range, because I don't think you need more than that for an hour and a half or a 2 hour, like World Cup style schemo race, personally. But then in terms of sodium, again, that sort of, you know, to your point, that definitely varies basically according with the fluid intake. So in the winter, I have a much lower sweat rate because it's freezing and I'm training. Like this morning, it was, you know, 5 degrees during my intervals or whatever. And I don't sweat nearly as much as I do in, you know, the exact same workout on a bike in the summer. And so I do load sodium, but I kind of take it sort of in proportion to the fluid I ingest. So for me, I've done some sweat tests and I have a very high sweat rate, but a fairly low to medium sodium sweat rate, I guess. So it's sort of on the lower end. It's about like 300 milligrams per half liter. And yeah, I that's sort of what I add, you know, to whatever bottle size I'm using, and then, you know, sort of adjust the actual fluid level according to the temps. And so, you know, in the winter, just to be, you know, more specific, I guess, a normal hard training or race session, I'll shoot for about 500 mils an hour, which is, you know, 300 milligrams of sodium in there for me and my sweat rate. It's really hard to actually get down more than that during schemo, just because how difficult it is to drink and eat, with, you know, every second you're not using your poles, you're losing time. So it's very challenging. But on a bike in the summer, I drink quite a bit more than that. And in Leadville, for example, I drank a lot, and had, I think I averaged about 800 milligrams of sodium per hour there, but I also had a lot more fluid intake across the day. Basically adjusted as the temps warmed up, my bottle concentration got diluted. I took in more gels and a lower concentration in the bottle, just to not make it feel as like hard to ingest. And I also had like bottles of plain water that I was using to simultaneously like dump on myself to cool off, as well as ingest, you know, extra fluid as the temps warmed up. But that, you know, that part is pretty dependent on the athlete, their sweat rate, the conditions. There's just so many variables that actually affect, you know, how much fluid and correlating sodium, you know, one should probably ingest. Whereas the carbs themselves, I don't really, I don't vary as much on that, you know, I guess.
Yep. Yeah. Cool. Thanks. Josiah, what do you think, whether it's your own training and racing or, you know, you coach athletes, you're probably talking to them about, hey, what's the fueling plan for the upcoming event? You know, are you helping someone make a plan in terms of, you know, grams of carbs per hour plus milligrams of sodium per hour plus approximate amount of, you know, water per hour? Is that kind of things that you're looking at?
Yeah, absolutely. Before any big race, especially longer races, asking the athlete to come up with a nutrition plan to run by me, you know, a couple weeks out. I mean, obviously, this is a conversation that you have several times a year.
Yeah,
it's ongoing. But making sure there's, for one, no red flags. And to John's point, like some of these, same thing. I had an athlete, you know, send me an Excel spreadsheet that was just so elaborate with what they're having, you know, every 15 minutes. And it was like, you know, this, you know, a salt tablet, you know, half of a, or one quarter of a, you know, waffle, and, you know, this much of a, you know, drink. And it was like, oh my gosh, like it took
a shot of courage. They probably had a jar that said courage on it. And they're just, whatever's in that jar, right, Josiah? They're drinking it.
So let's simplify this a lot. Like, okay, like these numbers, you know, these numbers that are coming out are pretty close to what you should have, but let's simplify this big time. And you know, this is what you need for the calories per hour. This is what you need for the sodium per hour. And a product that I've used for most of my career, which has evolved as more products have become available, the First Endurance line. And so like their drink, the EFS Pro, has about 500 milligrams of sodium per serving. And so for most of my events that I'm using that product, there's not a need for me to supplement with any like electrolyte pill or tablet. Most of the big championship races, you know, you talk about the Hawaii Ironman, you talk about Xterra that was in Hawaii for years. That's a very hot and humid environment. And there are some guidelines for that with that sodium intake. And John kind of touched on that range at 500 to 800 milligrams of sodium per hour, I think is a really good place to start. Sorry, I got a dog that's yelping that really needs to.
No worries, Josiah. So Josiah and I are both fans of the mini Australian Shepherd. And Josiah's got a pretty cute. What's your puppy's name again, Josiah?
Roo, like kangaroo.
That's right. Yeah, Roo, or yeah, like road in French. But yeah,
there you go.
They're hyped up. They need their exercise. They're just like John Gaston. They got to get out the door, you know, train hard in the cold.
Or like kids, like my son.
Or Porter. Like kids. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. I always used to say, like, you know, me and my kids and my dogs, if we have enough to eat and we get exercise, we're all okay. And if any of part of that doesn't get those things, then like, man, things go to shit. So,
I mean, it's just like being a parent, like your goal is to like tire your kids out so they fall asleep earlier every day.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. So do that with your dog and do it with yourself too. Yeah. Okay. So Josiah, you're saying even, you know, let's say the Xterra World Championships, that's a, you know, what, two and a half hours. And you're still shooting for high sodium of maybe 500, 800 milligrams per hour. And sometimes that's limited on logistics. You know, if you're in the Tour de France and you're the team leader, you get whatever bottles you need anytime and someone brings them to you. You know, if you're in Xterra or even in the Leadville 100, John's talking about all these bottles, but you know, you can only get bottles at certain points, John. So you got to, the logistics become part of the calculation depending on the
absolutely.
Course.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is kind
and
of part of
then
the
with, you know, some of these, you know, like Xterra or mountain bike events. You're not going to be drinking when you're descending technical single track. Yeah. So you have to be taking in those fluids and calories when you're working the hardest, you know, when you're climbing and putting out a big output. So that can be a huge challenge. So most likely that rules out a lot of nutrition sources too, right? You're not going to be chomping down a bar or, you know, even doing a chew is just going to stick in your mouth if your heart rate, you know, is 90% of your max, 95%, that's going to become really difficult.
Yeah.
And, you know, you mentioned like your, you know, some of your athletes with these like overly complicated spreadsheets and breaking down like the sort of their nutrition, like their intake intervals just to these extremes. And I think a lot of people also kind of forget, like to your point, whether it's the tour or an ultra or an Ironman or a ski mo race, like the pros are actually, you know, they have these goals, you know, for carbs per hour and for fueling, but they're extremely flexible as to when and how they can ingest those because they have to be, you know, and they have to read the race. You're not going to be, you know, oh, an attack goes in the tour. You don't say someone, hey, can you hold up a second while I get this gel in first, you know, or in Schemo, like, you know, you can't eat on descent ever. And, you know, half the climbs you're breathing under your eyeballs. And so like, if you're in a technical spot, you got to wait. And so it means sometimes going longer than you'd like between, you know, whether it's fluid and or fuel, and sometimes loading up sort of, you know, ahead of time, because same deal. Like, I mean, Leadville is a great example. Like everyone thinks, oh, it's a super long race. There's, you know, you should always be going easy enough to eat as much as, you know, you want when you want. And like that can sort of in theory make sense, but I can tell you in the moment, you know, if you are on like the steep upper half of Columbine, it is extremely difficult to actually even rip a gel and get it in your mouth. And yet on the descent, you have almost 20 minutes where you are just flat out and can't, it would be way too dangerous to even take your hand off the bars. So it can be, you know, in races of almost any duration, you will find yourself in these less than ideal spots, and you definitely need to basically train to be able to, you know, be flexible enough to take in a little more than you need to sometimes and a little less other times, and make sure your body can handle that and that mentally you can handle it too. Because I think some of these athletes that get so hung up on their fueling, if they miss that perfect timing window and then it gets in their head and, you know, they blow, you know, the rest of the race because they're just kind of off their game. And, you know, that definitely, you know, pros aren't just pros because they're fit. They're also mentally tough and are adaptable to a lot of different situations that I don't think everyone always, you know, realizes.
Yeah. I like it.
Like it is a race in the outdoors in a lot of times in some gnarly mountains. It is not, you know, some perfectly flat, perfectly paced, you know, simulation on a trainer.
Yeah.
So thinking about where on the course, not just when. So having that instead of, okay, every 30 minutes I'm having a gel is okay. Exactly. I'm going to have it at this, you know, let's get out the course map and let's look at, you know, where could you take in some fluids? Where can you take in the calories?
Yeah. I like it. Yeah. Man, you guys are smart. So, and that's why you're here. Final 7 minutes. So I think we're in agreement, you know, shorter, faster races. And for some people that might be in the Leadville 100 bike, you know, for other people, the Leadville 100 bike, maybe that gets into kind of the longer, slower range. But let's say, you know, a longer, slow race, you know, and maybe for, let's just, you know, for example, 100-mile run or like an adventure race that's 24 hours or Josiah did the Eco Challenge, you know, that's many days. My thought as a race gets longer and slower is that there's a little bit more flexibility and variety in the fuel intake. So, you know, John was saying, like, you're going to just go hammer all day long. You can do it on one simple fuel source, just high octane carbs and some sodium and some water. I think if you're talking, you know, let's say 5 days, it might actually be nice to have some variety, have some real food, and, but just like John said, have some flexibility.
You know, I should, again, like I already prefaced, I definitely can't speak to the ultra realm, but certainly in a race of, you know, an adventure race, like the Eco Challenge and all, I know, like, between talking to Josiah Little or Closier back in the day and Sarah Anderson and that adventure racing crowd, that is a whole different ballgame. And I absolutely do not propose anyone do those on pure, like, you know, dual source sugar. That sounds like a horrible idea. I will say, and I'll let you guys take it because I know nothing on this and you guys should go from there. But I found it curious in the last couple of years that some of the elite, like, ultra guys like Walmsley and Killian, who are admittedly both sponsored by Martin, but they have been doing a greater and greater percentage of those races, whether it's Hard Rock or UTMB or the like, on very simple fuels, with less and less, it seems like, every year, additional, you know, solid fueling. But that being said, those are still 1 day or less races. After that, gosh, I have no clue. So I'll let you guys take it from there.
Nice. What do you think, Josiah? And John, we are signing you up for the next Eco Challenge. We were going to tell you that at the end, but so, you know, get ready. But Josiah, what do you think? You know, someone's going to be out there for, you know, 20 plus hours, probably going pretty slow. What should they consume during something like that?
Well, I think a couple of things to think about is, what can you carry with you? Mm-hmm. How often, you know, are those transition areas or areas where you can refuel, stock up? Again, being super adaptable and flexible with your fueling is pretty important. I remember, I don't know if this happened to you, Travis, but in Eco Challenge, like, it's really hard to, well, it's hard to anticipate how long you're going to be out there. So if you keep thinking, I'm going to be gone for 24 hours, and it seemed like it always was 30 hours or 48 hours. Yep. And so sometimes you run out. You run out of fuel. And so, you know, we ended up eating some pretty low grade tuna out of a can that we found at, you know, somebody's house along the way. So there's a lot of different things that play into it. And flexibility is kind of the key there. And you just have to stay consistent. And you have, with adventure racing, you have teammates to kind of look after you. But big red flag if you have a teammate who's not eating, and you kind of you have to keep that. Eating is going to keep your motivation high, and you also have to keep motivated to eat. And so you have to be disciplined to keep that fuel coming almost no matter what it is.
Yep.
Yeah. Keep putting in the calories. Travis, what do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I agree with that stuff. One thing I tell clients, especially, you know, you're in an ultra run and the gut goes kind of south, the flexibility is huge. And I would also say any calorie is a good calorie. So, you know, if you're having trouble eating stuff and what you planned on eating, you know, isn't going down or is making you sick, well, then you're flexible. What else is there? What do they have at the aid stations? You know, maybe you're at the Leadville 100 and they have mashed potatoes or ramen noodles that have some calories and they're warm and there's probably some sodium in both of those. You know, either of those is way better than nothing. And I would also say, you know, John, you made a great point about elite ultra runners like Jim Walmsley or Killian Jornet, you know, doing an entire 100 miles on one fuel source. Maybe it's Morton or maybe something else. One difference, I think, is those guys are fast enough and strong enough that their body is ready to run at a high rate for the entire time. And for most people doing a 100 miler, a key difference is, you know, there's probably going to be quite a bit of survival mode where they're trying to make it through, you're going all night long, you know, different temperatures, again, you know, potential gut issues, So they're just, it gets a little bit more dynamic. But that said, you know, I mean, I don't know, I've done some ultras. I mean, I remember 100K I did one time, and like at the aid stations, they had one gel and it was a pretty remote race. So like no drop bags. And it was like, this is what they have every single time I go to an aid station. I'm just getting a bunch of gels and I'm eating one every 15 minutes. And, you know, it worked. I made it. Like I was totally sick of it by the end, but like I kept going, you know.
I'd like to hear your guys' thoughts on, because again, I do run, but nothing like you guys do. So I don't really deal with these things on a personal level, but I know it's very common, you know, in really any long race that's at a, you know, a measurably lower intensity, but it probably, especially even in an ultra, on an ultra run, you know, people are very quick to get behind very early on both fueling and hydration, because they're not hungry and they're not thirsty. But I've, you know, at least in my like own personal experimentation, I've noticed a huge correlation between like almost any gut issues I ever have are highly linked to dehydration. And I think a lot of people maybe don't quite realize that, like they're almost afraid of consuming fluids because they feel like it's going to slosh around in their gut. When in reality, if you don't consume water and but you are consuming a high, you know, carbohydrate or, you know, just calorie load, that's going to severely inhibit absorption rates and gastric emptying if you're also dehydrated. And it's this like death spiral that people get into where they don't want to drink because they're worried about their gut hurting, and then their gut keeps hurting and it just goes on and on. And I don't know if you guys feel like that's maybe one of the issues or if I'm just totally off base there. And I just, you know, but I'm curious.
I think that's where some experience can come into play a lot too, where you can have some of those identifiers. You know, if you are staying pretty consistent with your fueling and you're having that gastric distress, a lot of times you have too much concentration of carbohydrate in your gut, right? And so your stomach's not emptying. So, you know, telltale signs would be like the bloating, would even be abdominal pain. You need to dilute what's in your stomach, right? So you need to take in some water. And so kind of recognizing some of those signs, I think, is pretty important. And then like Travis was talking about some of those ultra events, like, you know, realizing, you know, when things are going south and being able to change course. And unfortunately it's not identical one year to the next, one race to the next, some things that you do something exactly the same and have a different outcome.
Yep.
So that's what can be tough about those races.
Yeah. Yeah. And different climates, different elevation, you know, people go up to Leadville, whether it's for the bike or the run or, you know, one of these other high altitude Colorado events, often the digestion goes a bit differently. So, there's a lot of variables. And there's John, I really like what you said, fuel from the start, you know, don't say, oh, I'm not going to consume anything for the first couple hours because I don't need it or something. I mean, I like Josiah said, do more with more, stay on top of it. You know, if you can prepare in that specific environment, which depending on where you live and what you're training for, you know, may or may not be possible.
Early and often, you know, fueling, and it's not necessarily to get the energy that you need right then. It's
exactly.
to delay that glycogen bonk that is kind of inevitably going to happen depending on how long and how hard you're going for. So if you're saying, how hard can I go for 4 hours? Well, you're going to need, okay, I've got, you know, X amount of glycogen stores in my muscles and liver right now, and that's pretty limited. So you're topping off those stores by taking in those calories, starting as early as possible, just so that you can maximize it throughout the race. And then if the race is really short, you don't have that same issue. Like say it's a 2 hour event, you have a little bit more room for error. Maybe you only need to take in, you know, 200 calories per hour, or maybe it's even a little bit less, because you can make some mistakes, and not pay that big bonking price for it. With the events that I do, the Xterras, it can vary from course to course too, because some of the most challenging courses for fueling are the really hard mountainous courses that have a lot of elevation gain on the bike and the run. And you really have to nail your nutrition there. And then the races that are really intermittent, like think of like a forest on the East Coast where a lot of, you know, 10 second power, 30 seconds at the most, and you're off the gas a lot, on and off, on and off, on and off.
Yep.
You're able to get away with a lot less fueling for that race. You can make some mistakes, you know, miss some feeds and be okay. But then if you try to, you're talking about a race that's maybe closer to 3 hours long with tons of elevation gain, you can really have the wheels come off if you get really depleted, over 2 hours.
Yeah. I'd love your, I would agree entirely with basically everything you just said. I'd love like the runner's perspective on, and maybe this is, you know, something I heard as hearsay, but, to bring up that 2 hour mark is sort of like a classic one people use. And personally, I absolutely think you can get away with less in those races, but at the same time, I read or was on a podcast, they're talking about like, you know, development of Martin with Kipchoge for that sub 2 project. And Kipchoge is a tiny guy. And I read he was, and is, and even in his current, you know, records, like the one I just said a couple months ago, is fueling at like 100 to 110 grams an hour from the start. And the whole premise isn't that he needs it at all, basically until the last 20 or 30 minutes of the race, because everyone's glycogen stores, and you know, the more elite you are, the faster, like, yeah, you might have slightly larger glycogen stores, but you're also burning through them even quicker. And everyone after, like, well, not everyone, but a lot of people after that 90 minute mark can start to see, even if they don't recognize it, like some slight performance, you know, declines. And that he was, even in the race as short, I mean, I say your marathon is short, obviously it's not short, but it's short in that it's 2 hours and not 4 hours for someone as fast as him, was still fueling at a relatively very high carb rate, just specifically to have that fuel on board, that glycogen on board for that final, you know, 20 or 30 minutes. And I think maybe, I don't know what it's like, for example, in XCO mountain biking right now. And I don't think people are, those are actually getting even shorter. So it's probably not to that level, but I am curious if like you're going to see even higher fueling rates, even in the short, you know, 2 hour length races, you know, in the next 5 years.
Yeah.
For that purpose alone.
Yeah. No, I think you're right, John. And I've kind of become a cyclocross fan this year. And so those are, you know, in the World Cup, it's a 1 hour race for the men. And you are, I think I'm seeing a lot of those guys, either they have a bottle or they're taking a gel somewhere. And, you know, obviously those guys can ride hard for an hour without taking in any calories. But, you know, they're finding it kind of like what you said, helpful, to have that. So, guys, this has been awesome. I sure appreciate it. Josiah has a puppy to attend to. John's got to go make some mac and cheese for his kids.
Pick up the kids from school.
That's right. And then you're going to finish their mac and cheese later on, part of your 125 grams per hour. So,
for sure.
I really, really appreciate it, guys. Thanks. Thanks a ton. This is all super valuable. I know that the listeners are really going to appreciate it. You know, they'll be following you guys out there. Is there anywhere should they find you guys on Instagram or something? Is that the best place?
Yeah, probably. I'm just John_Gaston1, and I'll be training and racing world champs later in about a month. I'll head over for those. So
cool.
See how it goes.
Schemo World Champs, right? What is the date of that, and where is it?
Yeah, that's over in Spain at the. It's the last week of February and the first week of March. So I'll be over there, and then that'll roll basically straight into the Pyramenta, which is like the biggest stage race in Schemo. And I'll be doing that with Cam Smith, another US member. And that'll be early March. And before you know it, I'll be on a bike. So we'll all be good.
All right. Cool. And Josiah, maybe a sub 2 marathon, huh?
No promises. Just like to throw down a respectable time. How about that?
Yeah, good for you. So the Mesa Marathon, that's in March?
No, that's in a week and a half, February 4th.
Okay, so cool. All right. Well, by the time this comes out, you probably will have done that. So people should look it up. We'll see how you're excited.
Yeah, and hopefully one and done, you know? We'll see.
Yeah, maybe so. All right.
And
well,
then,
thanks
then
a lot.
It'll be on to Xterras for me. So.
Well, yeah. I feel like thanks if you so start much. Running road marathons, you're going to have to do like New York or Boston at some point. I don't know. It's a dangerous cycle you're getting into.
I'm going to buck the trend.
That's right. And we cut you off, Josiah. So I know you're on Instagram. Is it just Josiah Middle or?
Yeah, just Josiah Middle for Instagram or Facebook, you know, just like it sounds.
All right. Yeah. MIDDAUGH. Yeah. And
or
also
middlecoaching.com.
Yep. Say that again. Your what's your coaching website again, Josiah?
Middlecoaching.com.
All right. Great. Cool. Well, good stuff, guys. Thanks again, and have a good one. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Good job.
Thanks, Travis. John.
All righty. See you guys. Bye-bye. Hey, guys. Thanks, as always, for listening. Again, I said it at the start. I'll say it again. If you're a serious endurance athlete, you might want to go back and listen to this again, because these guys had a lot of powerful things to say. I love Josiah's takeaway about simply doing more with more. I love how John talked about, you know, he's highly calculated with all this stuff, but he also, you know, eats mac and cheese and other stuff with his kids, as far as what's convenient with the family. If you enjoy this podcast, please do us a favor, rate, review, subscribe, consider sharing it with a friend, and please also consider checking out thefeed.com/Travis Macy. Search for the Kyoku brand on there, KYOKU. Awesome breakfast shake. I know that Josiah and John enjoy taking that from time to time, just like I do. And also be sure to check out the other things that John and Josiah have going on. They're both on Instagram. You can find Josiah's coaching at middawcoaching.com. And finally, since this conversation, I am pleased and proud to report Josiah did that marathon we were talking about. He ran 2 hours and 29 minutes. That, folks, is a very fast marathon time, 2:29:13. That's an average pace of 5:41 per mile, and he was first in the men's 40 to 44 age group. 2:29, man, that is a fast marathon time for anyone. He, of course, got the Boston qualifying time, and hats off to Josiah. Way to go, buddy. Proud of you and pumped as always. And also hats off to John, who was first place male at the individual race at the U.S. Ski Mountaineering National Championships. That occurred at the Wasatch Powder Keg Race on March 11th. So in addition to his many other accomplishments, John's got another SkiMo National Championships. So way to go, buddy. Very good. And you can see that, you know, all this stuff that these guys told you about fueling, it really does work. All right, guys, we will catch you next week on the Travis Macy Show. I'm going to leave you today with an excerpt from our audiobook. The book is called A Mile at a Time. It's been on shelves for a couple weeks right now. If you happen to read a book, or excuse me, if you happen to read this book and you enjoyed it, we really appreciate Amazon reviews. It's super helpful for continuing the movement, just continuing to spread my dad's story and his energy. So if you feel like doing an Amazon review, that's super helpful. And we're going to leave you today with the foreword for the book. This is from the audio version. You can find that on Audible or Libro.fm or other audio platforms. This is Mark Burnett's introduction to our book. Mr. Burnett created Eco Challenge Adventure Race. He also created Survivor, The Apprentice, Shark Tank, and is really, you know, kind of a foundational figure in reality TV. And we're really honored that he was able to do this foreword for our book.
Foreword. I first encountered Mark Mace Macy in the Utah desert in 1995. I was producing the first ever Eco Challenge, a multidiscipline, multi-day adventure race that had drawn athletes from across the globe. Along with those 250 competitors were 20 film crews, two helicopters, hundreds of crew members, reporters and camera crews from MTV, NBC, ABC and a massive contingent of print media reporters and photographers. The scene on the sunbaked ground was exhilarating, intense and borderline chaos. In the midst of the madness, I met a lot of competitors. The vast majority of their faces have been lost to the mists of time. Mace, I remember. This was an alpha-type crowd. I knew the type well from my time as a British Army paratrooper, tough, bombastic, prone to a certain bravado. That wasn't Mace. He was quiet and amiable, lean and tan. He certainly looked the part of an ultra-endurance athlete. But what really struck me about Mace was his eyes. There was steel in those blue eyes. They told a story, a short one. I don't quit. The story of that first Eco Challenge is well recounted in the pages of this book. But the short version is that Mace started as a member of one team. And when half of that team succumbed to the grueling 370-mile gauntlet of climbing, running, biking, horseback riding and paddling, Mace and a teammate made a field decision to join up with survivors of another depleted team. Right there in the desert, the newly formed team of weary but still willing warriors chose a perfectly apt name, the Stray Dogs. Together, they finished the race, and over the ensuing years, the team's members, including Mace Macy, would go on to become legends of the adventure racing world. I got to know Mace and his teammates a little bit better every year. To be honest, they were never a serious podium threat. They were perennially up against younger, stronger, faster, flashier teams. But like hungry stray dogs, they kept showing up. To me, the team captured the true spirit of Eco Challenge. When I conceived the race, I was never caught up in the winning and losing. The point was to tell stories, to capture the interpersonal dynamic within a group of committed people willing to sacrifice their individual well-being and comfort for the greater collective goals of a team. And what a story the stray dogs were. If the old dogs weren't favoured to win the race, they were always favourites of fans, the crew and the locals, wherever we went. Over the years, I became a fan not only of Mace's grit, but his spirit and humour as well. Of course, he suffered in those races, all the competitors did. But the tougher it got, the more Mace seemed to enjoy it. He truly was made for this stuff. As the stray dogs continued to add chapters to their story, the Macy family was living out another, more personal story. Mace's wife, Pam, would undergo three separate organ transplants over the course of 27 years, all while she and her husband raised a family of biological and adopted kids, the eldest of whom, Travis, had followed in his father's footsteps to become a world-class athlete himself. Trust me, it's a story worth hearing from the source. In 2019, 24 years after the inaugural Eco Challenge and after a 17-year hiatus during which, well, let's just say I stayed busy, we brought the Eco Challenge back. Leading up to that event, which was to be held in the jungles and mountains of the Fijian Islands, I recall reviewing a list of team applications. Some of the names I recognised, but most I didn't. It had been nearly two decades after all. Still, I shouldn't have been surprised. Scanning the list, there it was, that old familiar name, Macy. I can't recall if at the time I noticed there were actually two Macy's on the list, Mark, old Mace himself, and Travis. I would soon learn the remarkable course of events that led Mark and Travis, father and son, to Fiji. That story, so well chronicled in this book, has it all. Pathos, adventure, humour, despair, and joy in equal measure. Most of all, though, it has heart. Faced with Mark's shattering diagnosis of early-onset Alzheimer's less than a year before Eco Challenge 2019, Mace, Travis and Pam made a bold decision. Alzheimer's would not stop Mace from doing what he loved. They decided to stay in the race. Was it risky? Absolutely. Foolish? Quite possibly. But the fundamental question was this. Is there more risk in taking on a seemingly impossible challenge, or in folding up the tent and going home, wondering forever what might have been? The through line of my own story has always been one of risk-taking, To pull off that first eco challenge, I had to bluff, cajole, beg, borrow, and put everything I had on the line. People, smart people, thought I was insane to go all in as I did. In Mark Macy, I see a kindred spirit. His insistence on listening to his heart rather than the voices of the doubters has led him to places most people will never see. In Macy's story, and that of his family, I have found an inspiring reminder that with love, determination, and teamwork, the most formidable challenges can be overcome. Living the life you love is always worth the risk. Mark Burnett, award-winning producer and creator of Eco Challenge, World's Toughest Race, Survivor, The Apprentice, The Voice, and Shark Tank.
The Travis Macy Show is part of the Palm Tree Pod Co. network of podcasts. It is produced and edited by Anthony Palmer. The content for this episode is created by me, Travis Macy.